Good morning. Hi, everybody. Last week, Tim gave a wonderful talk. He came in and said, I'm going to do something audacious. He said, I'm going to give the Buddhist perspective on the Sermon on the Mount. And he gave this wonderful talk. And this week, I kept thinking about it, and it brought up so many things for me that I thought, this week I'm going to do something audacious. I'm going to give a talk on the Buddhist perspective on the Sermon on the Mount. If he can be audacious, so can I. I actually don't know that much about the Sermon on the Mount, but I did recognize the section of it that he talked about as being the Beatitudes. And that is about as much as I know about the Sermon on the Mount, so this may not match the original intent of the words, but it's what it brought up for me as a Buddhist. So that's my disclaimer. So first I'd like to start, as Tim did, by reading them. So this is how they go. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are they who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. One thing that I noticed about these right away is that from a Buddhist point of view, these aren't about the other, you know. Blessed are those poor people, people who mourn, those people over there, who this or who that. These are about all of us. And they also aren't fixed states from a Buddhist point of view, but they are like the realms. We can cycle through them throughout our lives, throughout a day. We can cycle sort of in and out of these. We can have times when we're poor in spirit. We all have times when we mourn or hunger for thirst and righteousness. So when we think about these, you know, it's not something out there. And it's also not something just in here. But it's the human condition. It's the way we all are together. So I want to talk about what they brought up for me, and you may have other ways that they resonate the Dharma for you, and we can talk about that also at the end. So blessed are the poor in spirit, for those is the kingdom of heaven. This reminded me of the first step on the Eightfold Path, right view, or upright view, as I like to say. It's not right view versus wrong view. I say upright view. This is the first step in an enlightened life. You know, when Buddha laid out his plan for, if you want to become a Buddha, what do you do? The first step on that path is upright view. You know, some people go through life and they never look up from the mundane. This is kind of astonishes me. Never look up from the mundane, you know. You get real focused on, you know, your job and the football game and the shopping channel and, you know, your dog or, you know, whatever it is. But you never say, what else? You know, what else is here? And Until you do that, until, as we say, bodhicitta has been aroused, bodhi being enlightened, citta being heart-mind. So until your heart-mind of enlightenment or awakening is aroused, you're not going to have that right view, you're not going to get on the path towards enlightenment because it sort of hasn't crossed your mind. So you need to have some kind of a vision, however dim it is. I don't mean a vision where you see something. I mean just a vision of being on a spiritual path, and however dim it is, you need to have that vision. But even after bodhicitta has been aroused, even after we're on the path, there are times when we are still going to be poor in spirit. There's still times when we say, you know, is that it? Is that it? There are times when we can be, really doubtful and even cynical and sort of longing for something that we don't even understand what it is we're longing for, but we know there's something. So I think when I think of being poor in spirit, that's what I think of. And when we are poor in spirit, it's the Sangha that holds us up. It's the community. It's our faith community. Years ago, I came on a Sunday morning, and just as I walked in the door, a friend said, how are you? Like you do. And I told him the truth, and I said, I'm just lousy. I'm cranky. I'm out of sorts. I don't remember what all I told him, but I just, you know, taught him never to ask that question. But when I said that, he said, well, then you've come to the right place. And I thought, you know, it completely, you know, it was one of those sort of turning words that just turns you. That's right. I mean, he's absolutely right. I'm in the right place now. And even if, you know, I'm still cranky, I'm still out of sorts, at least I've put myself in the conditions of being able to turn that around, having my Sangha around me. So that's the poor in spirit. Blessed are they, are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. There's a wonderful quotation from Dogen that at some Zen centers, they chant this at the end of the evening after a retreat. And the Doan, the person who's leading the chants, will get up and go to the Han, which is that wooden board that we bang on, you know. And they'll go to the Han, and then they'll chant in this very dramatic voice. But they'll say, life and death is a great matter. All things pass quickly away. Awaken, awaken. Take heed. Don't waste this precious life. And they'll go, don't waste this precious life. And they'll go, boom, 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 boom. And you're sitting there, you've got a whole day, and you can do it. It's really something. It gets your attention in a big way. But I think it's just such a wonderful quotation. I'm going to say it again. Life and death is a great matter. All things pass quickly away. Do you feel comforted yet? Awaken, awaken, take heed. Don't waste this precious life. It comes into sharp focus when we're mourning, not to waste this precious life. Last Sunday morning, I was awakened by a phone call from my mom telling me that her oldest brother, Joe, had died. He had what we call a good death. He was 94 and a half years old, and he died at his son's house with people who loved him around him. And I had seen him last June, and he died one year and 2 days after his wife, and he missed her terribly. And I saw him last June, and he told me, he said, you know, I'm not long for this world. He actually said that. I didn't think people said. He said, you know, I'm not long for this world. And, you know, there's nothing you can say to that. Oh, Joe, you're going to be Joe. That's right. He says, I'm not long for this world. And so we all knew that that was coming. But still, it's shocking when it happens. And still, we mourn, even though, you know, with someone like Joe, there's a real sense of gratitude for the life and the hope that, you know, we should all be so lucky to have that kind of life and death. But still, we mourn. I got an email when I came back from Lee Lewis that, and part of that email, he said, funerals and weddings are wonderful times to come together. The energy is usually alert. It's usually alert. And it's absolutely true. You know, when you are mourning, your mind in some ways is like it is at the end of a retreat. If you're in retreat for a few days, sometimes at the end, your mind is very cleared out and very spacious and kind of, it's sort of full of awe sometimes. The things, you know, sort of everyday cares. Last week I'd been kind of fussing about some things and I'd been, oh, you know, just, you know, that kind of fussing that you do sometimes. And that morning after the phone call with my mom, all that stuff just dropped away. You know, it just drops away when you're reminded about the great matter, not wasting this precious life. 2 years ago, my dad died, and I went to his funeral, and there were a lot of words of religious comfort that were spoken at his funeral, and I kept looking around, thinking these words are really comforting everybody here, except me. They were not. I didn't find them to be comforting at all, and it was because, you know, I didn't believe them, so, you know, they weren't comforting to me. And I came back and went and saw Tim and said, you know, I went to my dad's funeral and everybody was so consoled and so comforted by these words. And I said, so where's the consolation in Buddhism? I said, where is it? You know, I was in a little bit of a bad way. I said, I want me some. Come on. Hand it over. And we had a long talk. And he talked about this being a time when you really experience the interconnectedness that we all have with each other. And this is a time when we are very attentive to the preciousness of the other people around us and to our own lives. And we're real conscious of not wasting that time. And when we enter into that, when we enter in to that mourning and we don't sort of push it away or back away from it, we experience that interconnection in a very deep way. And we also, we're very clear and we really get how to accept the compassion and the love of other people, and also how to extend it when they need it. You know, how to extend it when they need it. It was after the worst funeral that I've ever been to years ago that I learned how important it is at times like that for other people to allow other people to help you, because they have all had their sorrows and their sadnesses too, and they want to help. And they want to help. And there's really nothing they can do about it except be there with you. So at times like that, we really feel those kind of connections. And I think there is a real comfort and a real consolation in that, I think. So blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. This one reminded me of the two paramitas, or perfections of the bodhisattva, the two paramitas of morality and energy. We put them together sometimes and call them morality. Morality and energy, or sometimes energy is called vigor. When we were driving out to the funeral, and so we had a long drive, we drove to South Dakota and back this week, and we were listening to all the reports on NPR about Haiti, and it's breathtaking. It's beyond anything we can talk about. And I was struck by along with the compassion of the people who were looking to help, there was also a strong sense of energy. We got to do something here. What can I do? What can I do? And there was also a very strong sense of morality. This isn't right. These people, you know, best of times, the poorest of us is better off than 75% of those people.
Yeah.
And so there's sort of a sense of morality that gets engaged at times like that. And people were calling in to the relief agencies and saying, you know, can I send clothes? Can I, you know, what can I do? I want to do more than send money. And the relief agencies were saying, well, right now send money, because what we really need is food. We need water. We need medical supplies. We need earth-moving equipment. Right now, that's what we need. But they said, but every one of the relief agency heads who was interviewed said, but please keep that energy up, because this is a relief effort that's going to go on for 5 years, 10 years, who knows how long. And so they were really hoping that people would be able to maintain that energy and those good intentions and those feelings of morality in order to complete the work. You know, later on down the road when they're building houses and they're rebuilding schools and they're rebuilding everything, they're going to need that energy. So it's my hope for all of us this morning is that we all give what we can, do what we can, and don't allow that sense of compassion and morality and energy to fade. The next one is, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And I actually had to go look up what they meant by meek, because, you know, we hear the word meek and we think, you know, mouse-like. And it's, oddly, I think, it's kind of a pejorative somehow. So I went and looked up what they meant in the text by meek. And I found a couple of places where it talked about meekness as being the capacity for going against our natural tendencies for resentfulness, passion, and anger, which was a real different take on it than I'd ever heard. And in a couple of places, they talked about meekness as taming a wild animal, the act of taming an animal that's naturally wild, meaning us, of course. So this brought up for me the paramita of patience and or forbearance, because the antidote for the poison of anger is patience. And when you think about it, when we tell ourselves, I am so angry, I'm so angry, what does that do? It solidifies the anger. It makes it seem like a thing, and it makes it seem like something that I am. And it also makes it seem like something that maybe isn't going to be going away anytime soon. So for the past couple of years, I've been kind of watching the way that I describe those things. So instead of saying, I'm so angry, trying to say, at least inside, I feel anger arising. And the reason is because if I remember to do that, it takes away a little bit of that solidity of the anger, and it gets just a little bit of a wedge in there. Just a little bit of a wedge so that I can see it and observe it. And after a while, you can start seeing the anger right when it happens, and you can watch it rise up, and you can watch it abide, and then you can watch it fade away. And when you watch it, the important thing is to watch it without judging it, you know, with sort of calm interest. And if you do that, you can have a little bit of compassion for yourself. You can have a little bit of patience with it. You can start seeing it as an afflictive emotion instead of, you know, this animal that takes over you or something. You know, we almost never, the Dalai Lama would say never, I'm not quite there, so I would say almost never need to respond with anger. We can always kind of, we can learn a lot, get some space in there, and even when anger arises, not let it go, not let it out. You know, we can say, oh, that really pushes my button, but even when it pushes the button on the anger machine, you know, we don't have to dispense the anger. We can just watch it and let it settle back down. So, forbearance and patience, that's how we do that. The next one is, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. And this one reminded me of one of the divine abodes, or the Brahma Viharas, which is loving kindness. And we have in the Saturday morning service here, we have this wonderful long Saturday morning service. And one of the things that we chant in that service is the Loving Kindness Sutra. And it is this wonderful chant where we go through all the beings that we would like to see be at ease and to be happy, and how we open our hearts to them. So it says things like, wishing in gladness and in safety may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small. I love that part. The seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. And then it talks about how we should cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded. You know, it just kind of goes on like this. It's a wonderful, wonderful sutra. And we chant it every Saturday. And there are loving kindness practices that I'm sure a lot of you know, where if you come into contact with someone who is having difficulty, you can send loving kindness their way. You know, if you encounter someone who's mourning, you know, may all who are mourning receive loving kindness or receive relief from their pain. And you start off with a particular person, and then you broaden it out to all beings who are mourning. May they be released from their sorrow. And you can do it for great big things like mourning, or you can do it for tiny little things like I have a very busy mind in meditation. And so sometimes when I just, you know, that little yak, 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 yak mind, does anybody ever get that? So sometimes when I'm sitting, no, Marty doesn't, everybody else does. So sometimes when I'm sitting and I cannot get it to shut up, I will just do a little loving kindness meditation. You know, I'll breathe in the yakiness and breathe out quiet or calm abiding. And I'll do it for myself for a minute, and then for all beings who have this kind of yakky mind, breathe out that loving kindness for all of them. And what it does, aside from calming my mind down, is it reminds me that I'm not the only person who has that kind of mind. I'm not the only one. And it gives, it takes away a little bit of that judgment of what a bad person you are. How many years have you been doing this, and you are still sitting here going yak, yak, yak on the cushion, you know? Let me see. Yeah, so I think that's the great gift of doing loving kindness meditations and loving kindness practices, is that it reminds us that even as I have sorrows and pains and scabs and scars on my heart, so does everybody else. And so when I encounter somebody else who's who might be a really difficult person for me, like, you know, say Marty. Hypothetically, Marty. So, you know, so I'm encountering this really, really difficult person who just, you know, pushes every anger button that I could possibly think of. But when I can remind myself that even though this person is making me a little nuts right now, I have scars, you know, and scabs and wounds, and, you know, this week I'm feeling really sad about my uncle, and I remind myself that person has them too. They're different, you know, they're different, but they're there too, and we're united in that, you know, we're together in that. And so when I can remind myself to sort of hold that in my heart at times like that, it really helps me when I'm encountering somebody, either someone who's in difficulty, who's having some kind of trouble, or a difficult person. It helps both of them. So when I teach loving kindness or Tonglen meditations, this is the only time I actually give a double your money back guarantee on this one. You know, I have no idea. I'm agnostic on whether these meditations actually send out some kind of cosmic vibration that do something in the world. You know, I don't know. When I'm wishing, may Ben be at ease. I don't know if that does anything for Ben's life. But what I guarantee you is, if you maintain that kind of practice and you do that kind of practice, it will change your life because it will make you more compassionate. It absolutely will. That's the only thing I give a guarantee on, because I know it works. I have seen it happen in my life and other people's. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. For Buddhists, this one, I think, is seeing the world as it is. Seeing the world as it is. In Zen, we say nirvana and samsara are one. So this daily world of our troubles and our joys and our fun and our movies and our, you know, doing this and seeing friends and eating good food, it's the same as nirvana. They're both together. And it's that seeing clearly is what it means to be a Buddha. You know, Buddha is the awakened one. Buddha was the one who went looking for the reason that we suffer and the antidote to suffering. And when he awoke and saw clearly, that's when he became a Buddha. So I think that being a pure in heart, as Buddhists we don't see God, as Buddhists we become Buddha. We already were Buddha, so one of the things that becomes clear is that we can even see that. When we see with this kind of clear, open, gentle, awe-filled, not awful, vision, that can help us ameliorate our pain. I'm talking a lot about pain this morning. I apologize, but that can help us with our pain and other people's, and that's what inspired Buddha, to be able to see into and through the pain that we experience in our lives. So that's blessed is the pure in heart. And the last one is blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. This one, for me, this brought up another one of the divine abodes, another one of the Brahma Viharas, which is sympathetic joy. And sympathetic joy is that quality of being able to be happy for someone else, no matter what. Happy for someone else's good fortune or good state in life, whether you're jealous of them or resentful of them, or whether, you know, no matter what, whether you think they deserve it or not, you know, drop all that stuff. It speaks to that ability to open our heart and, like I said on one of the earlier ones, taming that tendency to react with judgment and anger or resentment and jealousy. And with peacemakers, you know, we tend to, when we think about peacemakers, we tend to think big. And we think, you know, what can I do to stop the war? And then we think, well, it's too huge. We can't think about it. And so we don't do anything. But I got to tell you, I think that each one of us can stop the war. Stop war. And I'll tell you how. At the beginning of the Iraq War, you may remember, probably a lot of people here did this, there was a nationwide candlelight march. Do you remember that? Where in communities all over the country, people went out with candles in the evening and marched. There were a lot of them here. I did one over at Como Park. Well, my 70-year-old mother, who lives in a very, very conservative, small little farm town in Illinois, heard about this. And she said, well, I wonder if there's one in my town. And I'll bet you anything, there had never been a peace march in this town ever. And so somehow she found out that there was one. And she went downtown to the circle. You know, all little towns have a little square or a little circle that all the cars drive around. And that's where it was. There's a little park in there. And she went down there and found a small group of people with their candles, and they marched around the circle that has a war memorial in the middle. And you know, she had never been on a peace march in her life. And I'm sure there had never been a peace march in this town, ever. And she told me about it later, what it was like walking. You know, in these little towns, everybody knows everybody. So everybody driving by knows who you are. They know where you live. And I was thinking about that and thinking about these people driving by and seeing these marchers, and some of them probably feeling hostile to these peaceniks, you know. But also, in some way, some of those drivers must have had their hearts turned just a little bit. Just a little bit by seeing that. And I think that our little actions of going out, being a peace marcher, doing those little actions that we do, can just make those little bitty turns. You know, it's like an earthquake that causes the tsunami. And that's the way that we can stop war or do, you know, stop the big tragedies of the human-made tragedies of the world. So they didn't stop that war, but I believe it had ripple effects. But we can also, when we think about being a peacemaker, we can also think about our own lives, you know, being a peacemaker in our own lives. So by that I mean not escalating things, you know. When you have a Marty in your life, and he comes... Sorry, Marty. You're it this morning. So when you have a Marty, so when Marty comes up to you and he says something awful to you, you know, just not responding with anger to that, not escalating it, you know, not coming back with that really clever, really nasty remark that's just going to devastate him. I have a particular talent for that kind of remark. Honed over many years of practice. And it's a very hard thing to unlearn, but I'm working on it. So being a peacemaker in our own lives, you know, in the Midwest, we're known for being conflict avoidant, but sometimes that comes out as being passive aggressive, people say. But I don't think so. I think that we can do this without, you know, sort of storing that anger up inside and then having it come out sideways later on at Matt, you know. I think it's possible to just, you know, turn that energy when it's directed at us and become a peacemaker at those small times, When we were in the car this week driving out to South Dakota, there was an interview with Meep Geese. Maybe some of you heard that this week. She's the woman who sheltered Anne Frank's family. And they did an hour-long show on her. And during part of it, they played an interview from her. And she said something that really moved me. She said, "I am not a hero." She said that wherever she goes, whenever she speaks to people, she makes it a point of telling them that she's not a hero. She's just an ordinary person. And she said the reason she tells people that and makes a point of it is that she doesn't want people to think that you have to be a special person, some kind of special person to be a peacemaker, to make a difference in a big way. She said that she knew a lot of other very ordinary people who did way, way, way more than she did at that time. So she said, you know, "I'm not a hero. These are ordinary people doing these things." And right after she said that, the commentator said, "But of course she's a hero." Were you listening to her? Were you listening to her? It takes ordinary people doing extraordinary things to be peacemakers and heroes in this world. So, that's our job as Buddhists, to turn towards, to orient ourselves towards the direction of peacemaking, to orient ourselves towards being pure in heart and merciful and compassionate, having patience rather than anger, having morality and keeping up that energy of not turning away from our pain, from maintaining right view. You know, we spend a lot of energy oftentimes berating ourselves for not achieving some level of attainment. And I just wonder how it would be if we spent a little more energy just noticing our habitual tendencies, watching what arises, getting just that little bit of space in there, and then restraining ourselves from responding in a way that causes pain. Responding in a way that promotes happiness and kindness and peacemaking and mercy in the world. As Buddhists, that's our mission. That's what we're about. So, that's chapter 2 on the Sermon on the Mount from a Buddhist point of view. We'll see what next week's speaker has to say about it. Does anybody have anything they want to say?
Eventually his heart was so turned that he actually organized a parachute of candy to open in Berlin, and so he started looking at the Germans, not as Germans, but as human beings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not as the other. Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Rosemary, when you were talking about grieving and something after that, I was reminded of the phrase of the teacher. I believe he used to sit there quite frequently. He used to say, "Life is an emergency case."
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was kind of implied in what you're saying, but the opportunity to view the brevity of life and that deep connection that sometimes comes in grieving, it is always available.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's part of our human condition that we sort of forget. It sort of fades away. That energy sort of leaves. And then at times like that, it's right there again. And you start thinking, we can wish to die when we're 94 and a half in our son's house. We don't have a lot we can do about that. But we can live the kind of life that when we die, we don't have regrets. and that other people are, you know, mourning us. My Uncle Joe's Aunt Adeline was at the funeral. So my 94-year-old uncle's aunt was there. We're a long-lived family. She's in good shape, too. It was wonderful. You know, it can be, you're right, it can be a very anxiety-provoking thing. I think one way is by making a practice of maybe when you meditate each day, picking a phrase or a short sutra that evokes that for you in a way that you will experience but not get freaked out, you know? Like, I like to chant the Loving Kindness Sutra. But I also really like chanting the Dogen quote, you know, life and death is a great matter. All things pass quickly away. Awake and awaken, take heed, don't waste this precious life. Because I think if we can chant them and kind of get them into our body, it takes away some of that fear or the anxiety around it. You know, we're so used in this culture, we're sort of raised with pushing away the things that frighten us, and leaning in towards the things that we want, the things that we desire. But if we can learn how to face the thing, well, Pema Chodron talks about this all the time. Face the things that scare us, and breathe those in, and breathe out the relief. You know, breathe in the fear, and breathe out the relief of the fear. That we can become sort of a filter, you know, where we breathe in the toxin, and we can breathe it right into our body, and then breathe out the cool, fresh air and the relief. And it's a totally turned around way of looking at it. You know, it's totally counterintuitive. And you have to take that kind of practice slowly, you know, in little baby steps. And do what you can do in the beginning. But if you can start to do those kinds of practices, it will help you become upright at other times too, you know. I do them on airplanes or driving home on icy highways, you know. So I, all kinds of times like that. It really helps with fear and anxiety, I think. Anybody else?